Excellent. An ale for me. And for my officers. In fact, ales for everyone.
Oh. 10 backward. With Rick and Rick and Will and Gemma.
Oh, yes.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of 10 Backward, a Star Trek podcast from Nottingham in England. I'm Rick, and I'm with my co-hosts, other Rick.
Hello.
Gemma.
Hello.
And Will.
Hello.
In this episode, we're talking to a professor of astrobiology at the University of Edinburgh, Professor Charles Cockerell. Aren't we, guys?
Yes, we are. We're actually, sorry to spoil the illusion for anyone, but we're recording this intro after the fact. I think it's nice for listeners to understand the practicalities of our recordings.
Screw your practicalities. Yeah. I thought I was living a non-linear time existence.
You always think.
But I guess we can reveal that this is a very interesting chat.
Very, yeah, definitely.
The four of us are very enthusiastic about science, but I wouldn't say that we're experts.
No, definitely wouldn't say.
I would say why we are science enthusiasts.
Yes.
Yeah. Not amateur enthusiasts. I'm very professional about being enthusiastic.
Yes.
People pay you to be enthusiastic.
They would get great value.
But Professor Charles is an expert in astrobiology, and obviously this is a link to Star Trek because a lot of what happens in Star Trek relates to astrobiology. So we asked him a few questions. He was very considerate and gave great answers.
Great answers.
Yeah, really.
Yes. And this is that conversation.
In my experience, communication is a matter of patience, imagination. I would like to believe that these are qualities that we have in sufficient measure.
Captain. Incoming transmission.
Thank you, Lieutenant. On screen.
Charles, welcome to the podcast.
Yes, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to talking.
Great. So we're talking with you about astrobiology.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, so I thought we'd start with probably a really obvious question. But what is astrobiology and when did it kind of start as a science?
Astrobiology is a very old science in some ways. It asks questions about life in the universe. And one of its probably most potent questions is there life elsewhere in the universe? But it's not the only question it asks. So astrobiology is really concerned with how did life originate on the Earth? How has it persisted for over 3.5 billion years on our planet? And then, of course, could life exist elsewhere in the universe? And also, interestingly, could human life expand beyond the Earth? So I would say that astrobiology is really life in its cosmic context. It's trying to understand biology in that broad, universal context of how life on the Earth is set in that sort of wider astronomical view of other planets, how our solar system formed, and how life came to be here. And the word astrobiology, I think, was originated in the 1950s. But of course, people have been thinking about, is there life beyond the Earth, for a lot longer than that. It was just that in the 1950s and onwards, astrobiology was just a good word to encompass this connection between astronomy and biology. Just like, for example, you have astrophysics, which is understanding stars and galaxies. Astrobiology is just a logical word that describes an interest in understanding how life came about and whether it could exist elsewhere. But it's only really got going as a science, I think, in its full flow in the last two decades, with new missions to Mars, missions to the outer solar system, discoveries of deep oceans on Europa and Enceladus, and then, of course, the discovery of rocky Earth-sized planets around other stars. So rather than being a speculation about looking for life elsewhere, we now truly have a science with which we can test this question of, is there life beyond the Earth? As I say, perhaps one of the most interesting questions of astrobiology.
And as I suppose Star Trek is very much an exploration of looking for life in other places in the universe. I just wanted to ask, are you much of a Star Trek fan yourself?
Yeah, I am. I watched Star Trek when I was young. In fact, I always wanted to be an astrobiologist on a Star Trek expedition. The idea of landing on an alien world and characterizing its biology is surely every biologist's dream. I mean, we characterize life on the Earth and I study microbes, but the ultimate excitement would, of course, be to land on another planet and to study a totally different type of life. So from that point of view, Star Trek is a very inspiring series, particularly when you're young and you have an interest in space exploration and biology, like I did. Star Trek really brought those two things together and got the imagination flowing. I mean, you can read about factual ideas about life on other planets, but for a young person, Star Trek was really the embodiment of the idea of looking for life elsewhere.
So did you study astrobiology at university?
I did biochemistry for my first degree, and then my PhD, I actually did medical molecular biology. I studied proteins involved in blood clotting, and then I went to NASA in the US, where I did a postdoctoral position for 2 years, and that was studying life in extreme environments, looking for life on Mars, true astrobiology. And I ended up spending 5 years there before returning to work with the British Antarctic Survey, looking at life in extreme Arctic and Antarctic environments. So astrobiology was something I was always interested in. But of course, when I did my degree, which was in the late 1980s, astrobiology didn't exist as a subject. It wasn't the sort of thing you could do at university. I happened to be at NASA in the mid-1990s when the NASA Astrobiology Institute was formed. And that's really when astrobiology became formalized, it turned into institutions, it suddenly became possible to actually think about getting a job in astrobiology.
Just out of interest, you said you work with in Antarctica. What do you think of the film The Thing?
The Thing is one of my favorite films, absolutely fantastic. The best bit is where the spider legs come out of the dog's head and it runs across the floor. That is absolutely fantastic. I really like it. I think it's probably a bit far-fetched. I don't think there really are UFOs in the Antarctic ice. But as a piece of entertainment and as a sort of intersection of some pretty wild astrobiology with science fiction in Antarctica, it's fantastic. In fact, the first place I watched that film was in the library in McMurdo Research Station, the US Antarctic Station. And the best way to watch The Thing is in an Antarctic station with the curtains closed, listening to the Antarctic wind whistling over the buildings, watching The Thing. So it's an excellent film. I've watched it since then as well.
That sounds terrifying, though. I mean...
Actually, on a more serious note, I suppose, the idea that something extraterrestrial could be in any way compatible with us biologically, is that in any way possible? Is there a kind of basic building blocks of life that's going to be consistent? Or
yeah, that's a really interesting question. If you look at the chemical makeup of meteorites, particularly carbon-rich meteorites that were formed in the early solar system, you find that they've got amino acids in, which are the building blocks of proteins. They also have nuclear bases in, the bases that make up the genetic code. And they've also got sugars in there that form the building blocks of carbohydrates, of long-chain sugars in our own bodies. And finally, they also have lipids in, long-chain carbon compounds that make up cell membranes. So if you look at all the four major categories of molecules that make up biology on the Earth, the building blocks, if you like, the Lego bricks that make up those molecules are found in meteorites. So it's very clear that on the early Earth, those Lego blocks were raining down on our planet. If you went to another planet and found life, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was made up of proteins constructed from amino acids, carbohydrates made of sugars, possibly even a genetic code that has similar nuclear bases to the ones in our own genetic code, and cell membranes made of lipids. As we learn more about basic carbon compounds in the solar system, in the universe, I think what we're beginning to realize is that we're not exceptional. Our biochemistry seems to have some sort of reason behind it. It's not just a wild collection of molecules that could have been something completely different somewhere else. We find these basic building blocks in the raw materials of our solar system formed over 4.5 billion years ago. And so that speaks of some sort of universality of biochemistry and the chemistry of life. So I think it would, and a reason for trying to find another example of life would be to test this idea that in fact there are universal characteristics of biology wherever you would go in the universe.
One of the it kind of makes me think that one of the things we see a lot in Star Trek is so many aliens are obviously fairly standard template humanoid style. Given what you were just saying, and is then Star Trek maybe a bit on the money with the idea that you have what they would call an M-class planet, similar sort of thing to us, that you would have those basic building blocks, and it wouldn't be surprising to find life evolving along similar sort of lines, albeit with slightly different foreheads to us.
I think that's exactly right. I people always complain that Star Trek aliens look like actors with masks on and they're too humanoid. But actually, there's a logic even behind our own construction at the large scale, not just at the atomic scale, but at the large scale. You need some sort of manipulative appendages that allow you to work at fine scales. Tool building ability of humans comes from these very adept fingers that we have that allow us to manipulate things. You would expect to see those appendages. Giant claws, for example, are going to be no good for doing microelectronics or building spaceships, or in fact anything more primitive than that. So you expect to see dexterous limbs attached to aliens. If they're going to pick up electromagnetic radiation, you expect to see sensors. There could be some differences. We know on the Earth that there's life that uses infrared radiation or ultraviolet, and some organisms even detect magnetic fields. So it's not like there aren't other possibilities, but one might expect, for example, to see eye-like appendages. Eyes have evolved many times independently on the Earth, and of course they pick up electromagnetic radiation from our star. There's something universal about that. If you want to map the world around you and pick up a picture of the world around you and stop yourself from getting eaten, picking up that light, that electromagnetic radiation that's reflected off the surface of your planet is a sensible thing to be able to do. Evolution will tend to stumble across adaptations that result in eyes that can pick up radiation. So having eyes on the front of your head, which allow you to scan the world, is in some sense a very logical outcome. And hearing as well, if you live on a planet with an atmosphere, and I think any life form will have to be on a planet with an atmosphere, then sound waves that travel through that atmosphere, essentially pressure waves through that gas, results in appendages that pick up sound waves, in other words, ears. So all of these things they're not necessarily idiosyncratic, strange outcomes of evolution. When you think about the physics behind them, they actually seem very logical. They may be in different places on an alien. They don't have to look exactly like us or Klingon-like structures. Their ears may be in different places. But in fact, having ears at least attached to the side of a brain with some receptors for picking up radiation on the front or maybe on the front and back of your head, it could be in other places as well. But there is a sensible structure that's been honed by evolution. And I think that although aliens will probably look different from us, they may well look eerily similar in their basic design. And certainly at the atomic scale, the molecular scale, as I was saying earlier, I wouldn't be surprised if they had proteins and carbohydrates. When you scan them with a tricorder, you're probably going to find that you're looking at the same sort of biochemistry.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
That's really interesting, actually, because I always thought that the reason that most of the aliens we encounter in Star Trek look humanoid is purely budget reasons, as in it's so much easier to
octopus axes are very expensive.
Well, exactly.
Yes.
But it's interesting.
Well, that's the irony of it, that it is probably driven by budget, but in doing that, they may well have hit upon something that's more realistic than going for something completely different and outlandish. So the lack of budget may actually have ironically led to a more realistic depiction of the universal nature of evolution.
Oh, that's interesting. One question I was, what in term if our planet has a
a day of 24 hours, and it has, you know, its year is based on the time it takes to go around the sun. If life was on a planet where those things were quite different, would that life be different? I mean, would it adapt to that change? Would it look different because of that kind of difference in those factors?
There are all sorts of things about our planet that are linked to climatic and seasonal and even diurnal daily cycles. I mean, for example, the night-day cycle is something that is obviously very pronounced on our planet. If you lived around a binary star system where, for example, you were orbiting one star and there was another star further out orbiting your system such that you went through periods of having continuous starlight from two stars, I think life would adapt to this environment, and it might be different, but not wholly different. For example, the biochemistry of photosynthesis, gathering sunlight to make energy, when that becomes active, might be very different in a binary star system compared to our own solar system with only one star. But the basic evolution of biochemistry wouldn't change much. I mean, here's an example of something that is very unusual. Is the moon. We have an unusually large moon for any planet in our solar system. Titan, one of Saturn's moons, is quite large, but our own moon is quite unusually large, and it causes tidal effects on our planet. And you can record many adaptations of biology to tidal cycles, insects and other animals that navigate by the light of the moon, organisms that live in these intertidal regions around the edges of our coastlines, of our land masses, that are influenced by the tides coming in and out. If we had no moon, there would not be these large tides. There would not be these lunar cycles that we see in many organisms on the planet. But it wouldn't have fundamentally changed the ability of our planet to support life. Very few of these cycles, whether it's daily or annual cycles, make a sort of categorical difference to whether a planet can support life or not. What they sort of do is impose themselves on a biosphere, and they create certain characteristics in the time that things grow, the way that predators interact with prey, for example, by the light of the moon. So I think these things very much impinge themselves on the character of a biosphere. But as far as we know, they don't in themselves make a planet habitable or not.
I had a question, actually. In Star Trek, quite often we see the characters from the ship beaming down to the planet. They don't really know much about that planet before they beam down and start exploring. And
they're not wearing hazmat suits.
No, exactly. They're just wearing their sort of Star Trek pajamas, and away they go. And what sort of impact could such a foreign entity have on a alien planet?
Yeah, most of the diseases that we get on the Earth are quite heavily co-evolved with their hosts, like us. That's one of the reasons why there's very little. I mean, there is some, but there's very little in the grand scheme of things. There's very little jumping of viruses from one species to another. There are obviously examples of this, but generally speaking, it's not the case. And the reason for that is that viruses tend to co-evolve with the things that they infect. So the idea of landing on an alien planet and catching some disease off an alien biota is probably a very low probability, simply because your body is much more likely to simply treat any alien particles as foreign particles, in the way that your body does when you walk around on the street every day and you breathe in countless numbers of microbes and bits of soot and bits of plant matter into your lungs, millions of these things every day, and yet your body just destroys them. You don't suddenly feel sick every time you go out because you're breathing in lots of microbes. So it actually takes, and of course, if you did, that would not be very good. You wouldn't last very long. And that's why over millions of years, animal and organism immune systems are exquisitely refined to reject foreign particles. And that's why it takes extraordinary genetic adaptations for a virus to bypass your various immune barriers and successfully invade your body. Alien life would not have had the opportunity to see the human immune system. And so the likelihood that something would actually be able to get through these barriers and ultimately cause you disease would be probably very low. Having said that, if you were on an alien planet breathing in large amounts of foreign particles, some of which might have, despite what I said earlier, might have at least some different biochemistry, or might have types of proteins and sugars constructed in ways that your body hasn't seen before, you could imagine getting some inflammation or respiratory disease. I wouldn't really want to be walking around on a planet with a biosphere, an alien planet with a biosphere with things that look like plants and other animals, just breathing that stuff in. I think to begin with, I'd probably want to do some toxicity tests to find out whether that material was toxic to the human lungs before I went breathing it in. So I think probably some sort of gas masks when you're heading down from the Enterprise onto a planet where you can see this biology might be a good idea to start with.
And maybe off screen, McCoy just gives everyone a sort of anti-inflammatory injection before everyone goes down, and we just don't see that minutiae.
They may all take antihistamines before they get into the transporter.
I once heard a story regarding when Gene Roddenberry was pitching the original Star Trek way back in the early 60s, and part of his pitch was that he was trying to say it was scientifically credible that lots of intelligent life would exist throughout the galaxy. And to give his pitch more scientific credibility, he mentioned a known formula that was a calculation of the how many planets would potentially be inhabited by intelligent life.
The Drake equation.
It was complete when he did it. Yes. He made it up on the spot. I'm not sure if he was aware of the Drake equation existing or if he literally made it, but the formula he presented was nothing in no way similar. I was just wondering now, with sort of 50 years on, what's our thinking on the potential for the amount of life existing in the galaxy? Does the Drake equation still hold, or do we have a better understanding of what we would expect?
Yeah, the Drake equation is an approximation of the number of intelligent communicative civilizations in the galaxy. The problem with the equation, I think equation has always been a little bit too much of a glorified word to describe it. And the reason for that is that it's got terms in there that we really can't put any numbers to. For example, one term in the equation is the longevity of civilizations. How long do they persist? Do they destroy themselves before they manage to become, for example, interstellar or intergalactic? And we just don't know that. Our own civilization nearly destroyed itself during the Cold War, and it's not clear that we're going to avoid to do it in the future. So how long do civilizations persist? Another problem earlier on from that is the origin of life. How inevitable is an origin of life? Is it true that wherever you have a planet where there's liquid water and suitable temperatures, an origin of life will occur? Or is an origin of life extremely rare? And if an origin of life is extremely rare, then intelligent civilizations will also be rare, regardless of how long a civilization persists for once it does emerge. So all these things are completely unknown. And as a consequence, when you put those numbers into the Drake equation, you can come up with anything from zero to 50,000 civilizations in the galaxy. So it doesn't really get you anywhere in terms of the more fundamental question of, are we likely to ever come across intelligent civilizations Star Trek style? Or could we actually be living in a complete desert that is devoid of other intelligent life? Maybe we're the only intelligent civilization in our galaxy. And one can think of many reasons why that could be the case. So I don't think we're any further forward. Of course, one advance that has been made in the last couple of decades is having some knowledge now of the number of Earth-sized rocky planets orbiting other stars in the so-called habitable zone where there's liquid water. And we now know that about 30-40% of all sun-like stars have small rocky planets like the Earth in the habitable zone. So in some sense, that's very good news. At least it tells us that potential abodes for life are extremely numerous in our own galaxy, upwards of billions of Earth-like planets. The question is, has life originated on any of them? Have any of them become civilizations? And are they near enough that we could actually visit them?
Earlier on, you mentioned astrobiological projects in going to Mars and Europa and Enceladus. Which of those would you say is the most exciting and has the most potential to provide a breakthrough in astrobiology?
At the moment, I think the most exciting prospect is Enceladus, the moon of Saturn. And the reason for that is that we can observe plumes of water erupting out into space from a deep ocean under that moon. And not only that, the Cassini spacecraft was able to fly through those plumes and detect organic carbon. On Mars, for instance, we're still arguing about whether there's present-day liquid water on or near the surface. And people are still looking for minute concentrations of organic carbon that could be building blocks of life on Mars, which we still haven't really found. We found some organics, but it looks like meteoritic organics. But Enceladus has huge amounts of water erupting into space with organics in. So we've got water and organics, two of the basic building blocks of life that are not controversial, directly measured by the Cassini spacecraft. So in terms of the building blocks, the requirements for life, Enceladus is probably the most optimistic prospect in the solar system at the current time. And I would have thought the most sensible thing to do would be to fly a spacecraft through those plumes and see if it can detect life or even bring back samples of those plumes to the Earth so we can see whether there's any type of life in Enceladus's ocean. But I think what is exciting is the fact that there are now so many places we could go. Europa, the moon of Jupiter, has a giant ocean. We've now discovered ancient sediments and lake beds on Mars that are being investigated by Curiosity. Even Pluto, you know, the last place you would have thought had any interest to an astrobiologist, may have a subsurface ocean. It's very clear that the surface of that moon, of that planet rather, is active and has active glacial processes. Even Ceres, which is a tiny little asteroid, appears to have salt collecting on its surface that may have come from salty water beneath the surface of the asteroid. So everywhere we look now, we're seeing potential water habitats. Of course, these places do not have or not likely to have intelligent alien life. They're more likely to be bacteria, microbe-like life, if there's anything there at all. And it could well be the case that the universe has much more microbial simple life than human intelligent life that that the Enterprise might prefer to find. In fact, you might want to think about making one of the major objectives of the Starship Enterprise a microbiology expedition across the galaxy. It may be a more productive expedition than looking for lots of alien civilizations.
I know that we can. I know that we can see the atmospheric makeup from planets through the way that their stars shine through their atmospheres. Is there any indication in there that we could take for life on those planets, or is it too woolly?
There are so-called biosignatures that people are looking for in atmospheres. For example, in our own planet, there's very high concentrations of oxygen, 21%, and it's very difficult to get 21% oxygen without biology. There are few geochemical processes. If you break down water, for example, in the upper atmosphere of a planet into hydrogen and oxygen, that oxygen can collect. But it requires a very active star, very radiation-active star to break down enough water to provide high oxygen. So you can sort of rule out these things. So there are gases in our own planetary atmosphere that are indicative of life. If there was an alien enterprise or even an alien civilization just on their home planet looking across the galaxy, if they looked at our planet, they would see oxygen at suspiciously high concentrations and could probably conclude there was life on our planet. And that's exactly how Earth astronomers plan to look for life on these Earth-like planets around other stars. So now we have these growing catalogues of Earth-like planets orbiting other stars. The next stage is to build a telescope that's powerful enough to look at the spectra of light from these distant planets and look for gases like oxygen and methane and ozone as well, and maybe other gases as well, and search for life. People have even talked about looking for technosignature gases. For example, CFCs that are now banned, of course, on the Earth because of their effects on the ozone hole. But there may be other gases that are unnatural and could be what are described as technosignatures of an alien civilization operating on a planet. That's a bit more speculative, but the point is that atmospheres do reveal the presence of life, from microbial life potentially through to intelligent life. And our own planet has had this oxygen biosignature for 2 billion years. So if there are civilizations out there in the galaxy, they have probably known that there's life on this planet for the last 2 billion years. And we too will soon be able to observe other planets and figure out whether they've got life.
A little while ago, there was a news story that an object had come into our solar system called Oumuamua. And there were some stories about how that might be an alien object. And there was some discussion about perhaps it was a solar sail or something. I think that was kind of quite quickly discounted. But when you heard of that story, what did you think?
Well, I think it's really exciting that there's material from other solar systems coming through our own solar system. You could imagine, quite apart from the possibility of it being alien, but one could simply imagine launching missions to intercept these objects. If we can track them before they enter the solar system and then plan missions to intercept them, we could potentially get material from other solar systems and start studying the makeup of other planets around other stars with direct samples. I mean, imagine a sample return mission to an interstellar object that's traveling through our solar system. I mean, how exciting would that be? I don't think they are alien, of course, you know, I don't know, but I think the most parsimonious explanation is that these things are rocks from other planetary systems. But it is interesting, some of the papers that were published, for example, one recently from Harvard, suggesting that at least doing a thought experiment about whether this thing could be an extraterrestrial spacecraft. I mean, let's say, for example, we discovered a planet around another star that had oxygen in its atmosphere using telescopes. I bet that the next thing people would think about doing is sending a spacecraft to investigate that planet. Does it have alien life? Does it have any life at all? A logical thing to do would be to build a small interstellar probe, send it to that planet and have it fly past and take images and send them back so we can see what's on the planet. So that paper was an interesting suggestion that this object traveling through our own solar system could have been a close flyby alien spacecraft taking pictures of our own planet. It's probably unlikely, but one of the fun things about those sorts of papers is they get you to think about those ideas. How would we do that if we wanted to go and look at a planet around another star, which we might want to? So thinking about what are the trajectories you would use to investigate other planets, and you know, one should continue to look in our own solar system. Who knows? I mean, it sounds crazy that to think that these objects would be alien, but however unlikely we think it might be, we still don't know. So things that do come from outside our solar system and travel through, it's worth figuring out how to investigate them. If nothing more, we'll learn a lot about astronomy and astrophysics and other star systems, but one should never discount the possibility that something artificial might come flying through. At least you don't want to miss it if it does. So I think that object is enormously important because it's opened our eyes to the possibility of real missions to study extraterrestrial material and to think, to realize that we can think about missions and exploration beyond our own solar system. We don't have to necessarily even go to other stars. We can wait for material to come to us and investigate it as it comes to our own solar system. So that object has really opened up the whole science of interstellar travel, interstellar objects. It's made us think on an interstellar scale in a way that we have not done for a long while. Most of our thinking has been confined to our own solar system just because we've never thought about the possibility of getting real extra or interstellar materials. So it's a very exciting development.
Cool.
Yeah. Do you think we're limited by practicalities? And I mean, I'm thinking in terms of Star Trek, if something odd comes into our solar system, just dispatch the nearest starship. Whereas for us, with our current technology, it's it's not easy for us to react in any sort of timely manner. Do you think we're sort of limited by what we can do at the moment?
I think we are. Obviously, we can't at the moment figure out how to go faster than the speed of light. I mean, obviously, with our current technology, we can't get anywhere near that either. But as far as we know, there's also no good physics that tells us we can go faster than the speed of light. There are theoretical ideas about wormholes, of course, but we still don't have any good physics that tells us that we can put a large object like a spaceship through a wormhole and have it reappear at a destination of our choice. And so we are limited. However, objects like the one that recently came through our solar system were not so far away. I mean, that was, I think, 0.3 AU. It came between, it was within the inner solar system. So we could, if we could track those objects, they're very small, of course, and they give out very little radiation. So they're difficult to detect because there's not much of a signal to detect. But we can improve our ability to do that. And if we could detect these objects, there's no reason why one shouldn't send a mission to intercept them in the same way that we send missions to comets and asteroids and to Pluto. We've sent a spacecraft to the outer reaches of our own solar system, and these interstellar objects are much closer. They're coming through our solar system. So I think there's every realistic possibility you could send a spacecraft to intercept an interstellar object and either do a flyby, maybe even orbit it, but at the very least do a flyby. Ideally, you would eventually figure out how to land on it. That would be extremely challenging just because of the low gravity of these objects. Trying to get into orbit around it and put something down on the surface would be very difficult. But ultimately, that's what you would probably want to do, is get a sample of an interstellar object and return it to the Earth. So I think it's really realistic that we could have or work out ways to get interstellar material.
We've talked a little bit about the chances of life on a similar vein to us and in evolving in similar climates. What's the thinking in terms of looking at intelligent life developing in quite radically different ways? Life that breathes in very, very different, what we'd consider much more hostile atmospheres, or developing like completely different things like, say something like the Tholians on Star Trek, which are quite crystalline, or the Horta, which is silicon based. So what are the chances of life that radically different from us, are we thinking?
Yeah, there's always been a lot of interest in radically different biochemistries. The Horta are one example of a silicon-based life form, and a silicon-based life form has always been one of the favoured alternatives for an example of a very strange type of alien life. Other things people have discussed, like liquid ammonia instead of liquid water as a solvent, as a liquid to do biochemistry in. It's worth just starting with the Horta. What people sometimes forget is that silicon-based chemistry has been occurring on our planet for 4.5 billion years. And, of course, we know that chemistry is rocks. One of the things that silicon tends to do when it comes into contact with oxygen is form long silicate chains, repeating units that line up and form these chain-like structures that are rocks, are silicate rocks. In some sense, that the huge diversity of rocks on the Earth is similar to the huge diversity of carbon compounds, but the size of the silicon atom, which is slightly larger than the carbon atom, tends to result in these large networks of silicon-oxygen bonds. When you attach oxygen to carbon, you end up with carbon dioxide, and that's because carbon is slightly smaller. You attach two oxygen atoms to it, and you end up with this small molecule that is a gas, whereas silicon tends to bind these oxygen atoms in a tetrahedra because it's a larger atom, and you end up with a large network, in other words, rocks. And anywhere where there's oxygen, which is in most places in the universe, I mean, when I say oxygen, I'm not talking about high concentrations of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. I'm just talking about trace oxygen when planets are formed, oxygen that comes from supernova explosions. It will tend to form rocks, which is why rocky planets form in the first place. It's very difficult to get anything more interesting to happen with silicon. You can mix silicon with organic compounds, and people have done chemistry on what's called organosilicon compounds. So one might think about some sort of hybrid biochemistry where there's more silicon incorporated into biochemistry. One of the things I think that's fascinating about terrestrial life, if you look at what life does with silicon when it comes into contact with it, it does rock-like things with it. So you have phytoliths, which are these tiny structures in plants that are used in structural support to grow up against the Earth's gravity. And these are basically nodules of silicon that provide structural support. These spicules, which are almost like tetrahedral, almost in some sense sort of spindly fibrous-like structures you find in sponges, which are also used to make the three-dimensional structure of sponge skeletons. And there are other instances of this as well. When life gets hold of silicon, it does rock-like things with it. And I think that says something about the nature of that element and how it behaves. So unfortunately, one of my more less optimistic views of Star Trek is I think that silicon-based life forms are extremely unlikely. I wouldn't say they're impossible because I think that would be closed-minded. There's lots about silicon chemistry we don't understand. But I think it would need very strange conditions on our planet, like a localized environment with very low oxygen concentrations, to start making long silicon chains that might do something interesting and turn into self-replicating molecules. And so I think that wherever you've got planetary conditions, silicon will tend to form a vast panoply of compounds that we know as rocks rather than life forms. So I think the Horta are unlikely. I wouldn't say they're impossible, but I think they're unlikely. And I think there, again, is a sort of logic about carbon. Wherever you look in the universe, you find carbon compounds forming complex structures. Even in interstellar clouds, you find benzene rings and other complex carbon compounds that are recognizable to us as the building blocks of life. So organic chemistry, complex organic chemistry, is universal. Anywhere where you look, whether it's on the surface of Titan or interstellar clouds, the really interesting complexity in chemistry that looks like the sort of complexity you could build replicating bits of matter from, in other words, life, is all bound up in carbon. And I think there's a reason why we're carbon-based. And I think if you went to other planets, most other life forms, if not all other life forms, are probably going to be carbon-based.
One other interesting thing about the Horta, actually, in the episode Devil in the Dark, they sort of mention almost in a sort of throwaway manner that the Horta might be about 50,000 years old. I was wondering whether you think that's likely to we come across alien life that's so incredibly old that might have a lifespan way beyond ours.
Yes, that's also, I think, a really interesting question. Why do organisms have, why do they have finite lifespans at all? Stem cells build organs when we're born. Why don't we just continuously replicate or repair organs? Why do organisms have lifespans at all? Of course, if you don't reproduce, you're not generating variety on which evolution can act. So one reason why things might have quite short lifespans is simply because that's the best way for matter to replicate. If you have a very long lifespan, you're more likely to face some environmental change that then kills off all of that life. So maybe there's no particular reason as such. It's just that a fundamental result of replication, any planet where life replicates quickly, it will tend to spread across the planet. And that fast replication will mean it will adapt to climatic changes that occur on short timescales. So if an organism doesn't do that, it just doesn't survive. If it does, then it continues to replicate. So the evolutionary process may just generate this rapidly replicating matter that adapts to its environment and generates the variety that's necessary for things to replicate. So are the Horta old? Well, one interesting thing you can observe on the Earth is that life underground does grow more slowly. Microbes several kilometers underground have doubling times. They divide into possibly over hundreds or thousands of years simply because there's very little competition. They're not going anywhere. And underground, often the environmental conditions don't change very much. Some people have suggested that microbes might double every few thousand years. So if you had something like the Horta, even a complex life form living underground, I could believe that the conditions would be so stable that maybe they would have very long lifespans and they would replicate over very long time periods, maybe thousands of years, and they would be perfectly successful in that environment if there wasn't much competition and the conditions didn't change much.
So a while ago, there was a news story that astronomers had, they found a star where it looked like the light coming from the star was dimming. And this led to some speculation that there might be, that like a structure might be being built around this star, a Dyson sphere. And a Dyson sphere is kind of, it was kind of a thought experiment by Freeman Dyson. And in science fiction as well, we've had stories where vast rings have been built and humans live on rings, basically giant rings as a space station. And these are ideas that have come from science fiction, but how influential do you think ideas that come from science fiction can be with science fact?
I think science fiction is really influential on science fact for two reasons. One, because the more mundane reason is that science fiction writers are thinking about future possibilities. And of course, our perceptions of our future, although we think that we can detach our brains and come up with completely radical ideas, of course, everything we really think about is rooted in what we know. Even the most radical bits of imagination have to be constructed on some sort of precursor information. So people naturally, even when they're being very imaginative, are thinking about things to which society is tending to go towards in the first place, although it may not appear like that. So if you start to think about civilizations and what they might do, you would naturally start to think, well, maybe they might try and harness stellar energy more efficiently and build Dyson spheres. So I think that what happens is science fiction writers conceive of these ideas, and then as time goes on, science fact tends to converge on these things. I think a more interesting aspect of it, that the second aspect, is I also think that scientists are inspired by science fiction. I was inspired by Star Trek when I was younger and looking at astrobiologists. Of course, I can't go to alien worlds and find alien life. So there's a limit to the amount to which I can be inspired to go off and do science that's like Star Trek. But it gets people thinking. For example, a tricorder. I mean, there's a piece of equipment that was conceived within the context of Star Trek. And recently there was the XPRIZE Tricorder prize, which I'm sure you're aware of, where there was prize money available for someone who would develop a medical device that could diagnose a whole range of diseases using a single device. And there were a number of universities that tried to construct a small tricorder device. Science fiction writers come up with great ideas. That's what they do. They use their imaginations. They come up with idealized bits of technology and capabilities. And if you're a young scientist and you're looking for ideas to think about or things that might inspire you to go and build things, an obvious resource of good ideas is science fiction writing. So it's not surprising probably that scientists tend to pick up on ideas in science fiction, and then that motivates them to go off and design similar things. And I think that's much more interesting, the whole idea that science fiction subconsciously drives the science agenda is a really interesting, a potentially interesting phenomenon, because it shows that our imagination, our idea that science is very objective and we always do things in a very cold way is not really the case. There's a great deal of imagination and an optimism that lies at the core of science, and a lot of it is driven by science fiction and series like Star Trek.
Oh, cool. Well, one last very quick question before we have to let you go. What would your favourite Star Trek episode be? Any series? Fantastic.
It is The Devil in the Dark. Only because I think that's probably one of the... Well, actually, it's probably not the most radical life form, because, of course, they had energy life forms as well that actually, in some sense, you could argue... are even more radical than something that's made up of matter and atoms. I like it just because I think it edges on the plausible, you know, perhaps a radically different biochemistry that one could sort of imagine. And I think when I first watched that when I was younger, it was the first Star Trek episode I watched that really truly challenged my idea of biology, because of course the rest of them, as we said, really are slightly humanoid. So it was something that was really I was really taken aback by this thing that looked like a rock and was actually an intelligent rock. And when you go outside and you look at rocks, you never quite look at rocks again the same after you have seen the devil in the dark. So that for me was my favourite episode.
Brilliant. Well, Charles, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a really fascinating chat.
It has. It's been really illuminating.
No, yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for making contact. It's been great fun to talk to you.
Cool. If anyone wanted to find out more about the work that you're doing, is there somewhere they can find that?
Yeah. So the UK Centre for Astrobiology website, our website is astrobiology.ac.uk, and we can find out more about what we do there.
Brilliant. Well, good luck with all that work. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Transfer of information complete.
Thank you for your help.
Got out.
That was a great episode. That was a great chat.
It was. That was so sciencey. I loved it.
I think the coolest thing from that chat is that Professor Charles watched The Thing in Antarctica.
That's one of the coolest things I've ever heard.
When he said he went and worked for NASA for 5 years, all our jaws were just hitting the table. And then he went to Antarctica and just... So when Rick asked him about The Thing, that was fantastic.
Yeah. I really like that he loves Devil in the Dark. Yes. Even though he did call out the Horta as perhaps being an unlikely... But he really liked the thinking around a different...
Yeah.
Idea of a completely different life.
I really like that. Basically, we've had scientific confirmation that Star Trek aliens aren't all that ridiculous. Yeah. They're not cheaping out on budget. They're scientifically accurate.
Exactly. Yeah. Wrinkly foreheads and funny noses. That is exactly what aliens will look like. Science has confirmed it.
More or less.
Star Trek is correct.
Definitely. And he had a really great attitude as well. Because a little while ago, when we were talking about Oumuamua, that news story was on the news, and they kind of treated that news story quite jokingly about the fact that it might be an alien kind of artifact or something. They were like, how ridiculous. But it isn't ridiculous. It's fun to think that it is. It's inspiring to think that it is, and it will encourage people to get interested in space, won't it?
I think it's indicative of the divide that we have between our general news. So, this thing has come through, that and they have a little bit of a thing about it, and they think that fulfills their science news quota, where in fact the actual science community are all going like, this is amazing, what could we do? It's talking about how they plan manned missions to it, and all sorts of stuff.
And wouldn't it be cool if we could go to this thing and look at it, see what it is?
And do you know what? We need that side of the scientific community to be more openly shown in mainstream. And this is not the scientific community, this is the media community's fault for not showing that, because that's what's going to get more people into science.
Yeah, the last chap we talked to, John Holliday, he was similarly inspired by Star Trek, and cool ideas in science fiction are so inspiring.
Yeah, that's what I loved about his answer about your question around Dyson spheres and kind of ring structures around planets, and how he was talking about how that sort of imaginative thinking that ideas that come from science fiction are based on logically some practicalities around where societies might go in the future, and then that's where scientists might look to start building the new big thing. That was really interesting. Really cool.
Yeah, really cool. I still can't believe when he watched The Thing in Antarctica.
You're never going to get over that. Every time you watch The Thing, you're going to be like, Antarctica.
Rick's already like packing a whole bunch of jumpers and his DVD of The Thing.
Turn his heating down.
I might do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, save some money and have a great experience.
I remember once a few years ago, we had a really cold winter, and I was reading a book called The Terror by Dan Simmons. And that's all about a mission to chart the Northwest Passage that goes horribly wrong. And it was really cold, and I was reading it, and it was talking about things being really cold. And it did work. Like I felt more involved in the story because it was cold.
Oh, I love to watch The Empire Strikes Back on a snowy day, and there's no better day to watch it.
Yeah, well, Kai, you could cut open the belly of a cow and sleep in it while you watch The Empire Strikes.
No, I've got a restraining order because of the last time when
you've got a restraining order from cows.
Yeah, from the cow police.
The bovine community have been to court.
We don't want it anywhere near us. Well, because of the incident.
They didn't say that. They said. And then did this, and this is quite a like a podcast that's, I'd say it's got a lot more content than most of our.
Well, it did do in the middle, not right now.
Yeah, not the outro or the intro. We should wind it up and leave it there because we've got a few more podcasts to record this evening. So
yeah, but I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as we did, and hopefully this is a sort of a semi-regular thing we'll do. We'll try and find knowledge experts and talk to them and have a good old time.
Yeah. Although we will still probably do episodes where we talk a load of bollocks.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. True. Yeah. We've got
to
do that.
We've got to cater to all audiences.
Yeah, but thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next time with another episode.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Bye.
Do you realise how incredible this is?
What is tradition?
You ever noticed that bum?
What?
That bum.
Oh, no!
Enough of this self-indulgence.
Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, our website is www.lowerdecksradio.co.uk. You can reach us on the Twitters at 10backward, 10 being the number and backward being the word backward. We're also on Facebook at www.facebook.com/10backwardpodcast. You can also email us at crew@lowerdecksradio.co.uk. On a personal, individual level, my Twitter is at Will Turland. Rick Everson's Twitter is at TrekFanRick. And Rick Palmer's Twitter is at Mr. Imhotep.
Hi, thank you again for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, you might consider supporting us. We now have a Patreon where people can pledge small amounts to fund ongoing projects like keeping our website up to date, new audio equipment as we're going along, and potentially opportunities to expand our content. You can go look at this at patreon.com/lowerdecksradio. If you don't feel you can donate but would still like to support us, we would love it if you could subscribe to us on however you get your podcasts, your iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or we're on various third-party apps. And if you could leave us a review on any of those, that would be fantastic and would be very appreciative.
Thanks again for listening, and please tune in for more podcasts from the 10 Backward crew.
Let's make sure that history never forgets the name.
10 Backward?
Laddie, don't you think you should rephrase that?
10 Backward. 10 Backward.
In my experience, communication is a matter of patience, imagination. I would like to believe that these are qualities that we have in sufficient measure.